Oh, hi, how you doing, Ben? Here to get your shot? Okay, then me too.
This is my father, Danny Cantwell. And back in February, after almost a full year of hunkering down and staying close to home, he did what a lot of us are doing right now. He got his COVID vaccine.
All right, thank you so much, Danny. You want to take a seat over in that empty chair.
Okay.
And then they'll be out in a bit to get you, okay?
All right, thank you.
As a retiree with a couple of other health factors, my dad was in the first group of people to get the vaccine where he lives in Rockford, Illinois, the city where Maddie Fuller worked as a nurse more than 100 years ago. He said the process was quick and easy.
Yeah, it didn't take very long. I wasn't there 20 minutes. Yeah, they had it down with pretty good science.
After checking in and getting his temperature taken, my dad walked immediately into an exam room where a nurse asked him about any allergies he might have and then administered the shot.
The longest time spent was the 15 minutes waiting for, you know, to make sure that there was no reaction. It says, this is the third day and they've had nobody has had a reaction yet. You know, that they haven't had any side effects or anything. So they're very happy about that.
In the waiting room, my dad said there was a palpable sense of joy as everyone discussed the kind of workarounds they've had to learn to stay safe this past year, like ordering their groceries online.
Oh, yeah. I just picked ours up at 11 o'clock today. I mean, they just tell you what time it's picked.
Where do you do it at?
So I do it at the Walmart in Rockton, but then we also do it at the Aldi across the street.
Yeah.
Has it also.
Yeah.
So we don't go into the store at all.
Yep. Good.
After waiting for 15 minutes, my dad checked out and made an appointment for his next shot.
It's going to be March 4th.
Back with you. This is your admission.
Okay.
It tells what vaccine you received, and the back has your appointment date.
There you
and
go.
And you'll also get a My Chart reminder.
You're
okay,
all set.
Very good.
You're
thank you very much.
You.
See you in a month.
Bye.
I talked to my dad shortly after he got his first shot to see if it felt like this was the light at the end of the tunnel. And he reflected upon the ways in which the pandemic had altered this past year of his life.
You know, we normally would go see you guys, one of you kids, like every month. We would, you know, go to, you know, Nashville or Louisville or go to see you guys, see the games. And you just can't do that when you're fearing that you're going to get, you know, get sick by doing it. It's just not safe. You don't, I mean, you know, here you are, you're retired, you think you can do whatever you want to when you want to. And, you know, we had the means to do it and we had the time to do it and we could do it, but we didn't do it because it wasn't the smart thing to do.
But when I asked my dad what was the one thing he would never forget from this past year, he said that he could not get over just how many people chose not to take the coronavirus seriously, including people he knew and respected.
I mean, if you are intelligent and you're worried about your health and the health of others, then you had to significantly change your lifestyle. You know, I mean, a lot of people didn't. A lot of people don't. Some people died because they didn't face the realities of it. But it was, you were forced to make a decision that, are you going to sacrifice a little bit of time and freedoms to go and do things that you want to do for health and for the health of others. And, you know, that's what everybody had to make that decision, you know, if that's what they were going to do, or if they were going to say, as some of the anti-vaxxers and the anti-maskers say, that I'm not going to live in fear, you know, and they're just going to go ahead and live their life.
As my father's comment suggests, our thoughts and feelings about the pandemic will last long after we've reached herd immunity. I've heard some people talk about how they lost respect for friends and family members based upon how they responded to the pandemic. And for those who lost someone to the disease, the changes to families and friendships can be permanent. The same was true more than a century ago.
I think the times when they would talk about them is that when we would gather at the cemetery every Memorial Day weekend.
This is Jane Kapinski. While we were working on the Healthiest City, we put out a call with the Milwaukee County Historical Society to ask people if they had any family stories about the influenza outbreak. And Jane shared that her family still talks about someone they lost to the flu.
It was my great-grandfather, Hugo Kemmer. He was only 35 years old when he passed away from the Spanish flu.
Hugo worked at the American Hide and Leather Company in Milwaukee, and he managed to catch the flu before the city shut down. Jane said that according to family lore, it happened very quickly.
The story that I heard is that he did kind of catch a cold at work, and it had progressively gotten worse. He was at home and passed away there.
But while Hugo's illness was quick, Jane says that his memory still remains a part of the family's memory. As a child, Jane says her great-grandmother would take the family to Hugo's grave to tell of his life, and the family still meets there to clean the grave and plant flowers in his memory. But beyond this literal commemoration of Hugo's life, Jane says that her family's encounter with the flu shaped other family dynamics as well.
You know, it's interesting, growing up, and I was close to my grandmother, I now look at certain things that she was, she'd do every day. Like, she always insisted on gargling with salt water. You know, it's like, what? Well, you know, now that I've done a little bit more work behind this and research behind it, you know, it's one of the things that doctors told people to do was gargle with salt water. So here is years later, you know, that's what she would do. The other thing that I always knew she had in the house was a little jar of, in her medicine cabinet, was a little jar of Vicks. And that's another thing that, you know, from some of the readings, it's like, oh, well, you know, that was something that had just come out. It was a new remedy that everybody wanted, and it was very hard to get at that time, but she always had it in the house.
Leslie Heinrich has a similar story.
You know, I know that my great-grandparents were heartbroken.
The brother of Leslie's grandmother,
Frank Jacob Jertle, what would that be, like my great-uncle or something like that?
Also died from the flu while he was stationed in Philadelphia as a soldier. Frank had shipped out from Milwaukee in March of 1918, making it likely that he was a part of the flu's return to the United States as soldiers began crossing back and forth.
Mother got a telegram soon after he was out there, and it said, your son is sick, come out here. And so, of course, in those days, she took the train out there, and it was a huge rush, you know, to get out there. And by the time she got there, he was already dead.
Leslie says that her family kept a number of mementos to Frank around the house that both fascinated and frightened her as a child.
You know, one thing I remember as a little kid, so my grandparents had this wall of photographs, you know, and they looked pretty creepy to me because they were mostly black and white and stuff. There was this photo, though, that I was fascinated with because my grandma was on there, and his picture was, like, on there sort of floating. You know, like they had the photographer, I don't know, somehow impose him in that picture. And so it was kind of creepy, but fascinating, of course, to a kid.
But where Jane said her family talked about Hugo all the time, Leslie remembers that her family could never bring themselves to talk about the trauma of the influenza pandemic.
I like that we're talking about it today, that it's not so hidden. I think in the past, things were hidden, which is why I don't know the story, because this is the kind of thing, as a kid, I would have been just riveted by, but they never would tell us anything. You know, and so I think, you know, our experiences now, and that people are actually taking these experiences down, and there's a lot of archives that are collecting information on it. It's great. It's going to be great for the future for people to understand what we were going through. You know, and I wish I understood better what they went through then.
In the same way that a body can still suffer the effects of the disease long after recovery, families and communities can also be long impacted by medical crises as well. And how quickly one treats the disease can determine how enduring those impacts will be. On this, our last episode of the show, we explore how Milwaukee's rapid response to the flu positioned the city for a quick recovery. And we ask what the length of the coronavirus pandemic might mean for the future. From the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of History, I'm Chris Cantwell. And in partnership with the Milwaukee County Historical Society, this is The Healthiest City, a podcast about Milwaukee and its pandemics. Our pod story in Madeline Lampark has the story.
Today, it seems like the coronavirus pandemic is all that anyone can talk about. The spread of COVID-19 has impacted not only our daily lives, but also international relations and the 2020 presidential election.
But in order to understand the effects and aftermath of the 1918 influenza pandemic, we have to realize that the flu was just one of many global catastrophes. Because we cannot understand the flu's impact without considering its almost symbiotic relationship to the First World War.
So they kind of went hand in hand, really. And as far as long-term effects...
That's Kevin Abing, who you should all recognize by now, the archives director at the Milwaukee County Historical Society. And he points out how the war and the flu formed and shaped each other. On one level, as Christina and Katie showed in episode 3 of our show, the movement of troops facilitated the virus's spread across the globe. But as Kevin points out, the virus's spread might have hastened the war's end.
Well, you know, I mean, the loss of life from the epic, you know, the Spanish flu was, well, anywhere from 50 to 100 million people, depending on, you know, which accounts you look at. And then the war itself killed, what, 15 some million people? You know, there are some people who say that, you know, that the Spanish flu hit the German army so badly that it really sped up the end of the war.
Together, the war and the flu combined to absolutely devastate some communities. The global experience varied, but deaths were heaviest in underdeveloped areas. In India, for example, around 5% of the population, or about 12 to 17 million people, are believed to have died of the flu. Freetown, the capital city of Sierra Leone, was the site of the first outbreak of the flu in sub-Saharan Africa, and similarly lost 4% of its population in only 3 weeks. By contrast, the mortality rates in Europe were much lower, averaging around 1% of the total population. But the fact that both the flu and the war tended to claim the lives of the young still made their convergence catastrophic.
Literally, you have this lost generation of all these young men and young, many young women as well, who lost their lives. And, you know, they're in the prime of their life, and, you know, and they're gone. I mean, they disappeared.
The United States was in some ways unique during this period. Its relatively developed state and late entry into the war meant that its death toll from both the flu and military combat was smaller than its peers. Though the flu killed more than 675,000 people in the U.S., an absolutely staggering number, the country's mortality rate of 0.6% was less than that of Germany, France, and Austria. The flu was also fast. Unlike today, when the coronavirus pandemic has dragged on for almost an entire year, the influenza pandemic came in quick bursts or waves that would come on strong and then pass quickly. In many communities, schools were closed for weeks, not months. And some cities like New York kept their schools open throughout the flu's deadliest period. All of these things, including the war's end on November 11th, led many to move on from the flu relatively quickly.
So that economic impact of the flu, you know, it really wasn't as nowhere near as severe as you know, what we're seeing today. And you know, maybe that might explain why that whole pandemic just kind of, you know, once the war is over and the pandemic subsides, it just kind of got pushed, you know, to the back burner in a lot of people's minds.
This was especially true of Milwaukee. When the flu began to let up at the end of 1918 and cases in the city fell below 100, Health Commissioner Ruland began a partial lift of the lockdown. By late December, children could attend church services again, though face masks were still required. The city even lifted the ban on singing, allowing the boys' choir to perform on Christmas Day. All told, the city emerged from the flu relatively unscathed. When comparing death rates per 100,000 residents, Milwaukee was second only to Minneapolis, with 292 deaths per 100,000. By comparison, New York City would see a mortality rate of 452 deaths per 100,000 residents, while San Francisco would see 673 deaths per 100,000 by the pandemic's end.
And what's remarkable about these numbers is that while Milwaukee might have only been the 13th largest city in 1918, it was one of the nation's most dense.
But the interesting thing about Milwaukee at that time is that it was one of the most densely populated cities in the country. I think it was second only to New York in terms of population density. So, I mean, people are crammed into a relatively small space because Milwaukee at that time, it was much smaller than, you know, what it, the area it encompasses today. So it was very crowded.
The success allowed Milwaukee to reopen its city and its economy quickly after the winter outbreak. Despite the economic disruption brought on by both the shutdown as well as the end of wartime production, Kevin Abing notes how Milwaukee quite quickly moved beyond the flu.
So there was a short-term impact, but if the, you know, Milwaukee's economy really quickly got back to normal again, I guess you could say, because with the war over, I mean, all these wartime restrictions were lifted, and people were ready to spend money, and so that offset any losses that the restaurants and department stores and theaters, that spending after the war was over, offset any those losses that they suffered during the epidemic.
Madeline Lampark is a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee.
'29, men and women sure were dying from a disease, what the doctor called a flu. People died everywhere, death went creeping through the air. Father grown of the sick sure was saying.
Well, that's it. That's our show. And as usual, I'm obliged to tell you that this episode featured music by the Blue Dot Sessions and from the American Folklife Center, and let you know that it was produced by Madeline Lampark, Elizabeth Jackson, and myself, with help from the students of History and New Media at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. But I want to make sure that everyone grasps what it means when I say these episodes have all been produced by the students of History and New Media. In the fall of 2020, 15 students enrolled in a completely virtual graduate seminar, and on the first day of class, they learned that while they would be taking a class about podcasting during a global pandemic, they would also be making a podcast about a global pandemic. Everything you have listened to over these last couple of months has been plotted and planned by students meeting on Zoom, Skype, and other video conferences. They recorded episodes in their closets, cars, and other quiet places. And they did it all with an enthusiasm that sustained me during the dark nights of this past COVID winter. So I would be absolutely remiss if I did not thank all of these Podstorians again for their efforts at the end of our little endeavor. They are Ken Bartelt, Katie Bischoff, Keziah Bland, Tony George, Bailey Green, Christina Greve, Olivia Hoff, Elizabeth Jackson, Frank Kalisic, Daniel Kaler, Madeline Lampark, Roman Luloff, Rihanna Quad, Ben Schultz, and Maddie Tabor. Thanks to each of you guys for taking on more than just a class. As always, an extra special thanks goes out to
Kevin Abing.
Kevin Abing.
Kevin Abing.
Kevin Abing.
Kevin Abing.
Kevin Abing of the Milwaukee County Historical Society for not only helping us access the archive in the midst of a global pandemic, but also so giving generously of his time as he sat for nearly a dozen interviews. Thanks, Kevin. And of course, thanks goes out to historian Judith Levitt, whose book, The Healthiest City, gave us both the name and the title for our show. But in addition to these and other voices you heard throughout these past episodes, I'd also like to take this concluding moment to thank WUWM's Michelle Maternowski and Joy Powers, as well as Leon Nafok of Fiasco and Prologue Productions, for zooming into my class and helping us figure out how to make a show. Ben Barbera served as a crucial liaison between the bureaucracies of the Milwaukee County Historical Society and UWM, and for that I'm grateful. And finally, one final note of gratitude for everyone who gave us the precious gifts of both their time and their stories in sitting to be interviewed for the show. The Healthiest City is a production of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of History in partnership with the Milwaukee County Historical Society. For more information on the show, including photographs and documents from the era, you can visit milwaukeehistory.net/podcast. And as always, thanks for listening.
He is judging this old man, north and south, east and west can be seen. Yes, he killed the rich and poor, and he's going to kill more. If you don't turn away from your sin.
Do an interview. Yeah, your mom said that she was, when you responded, said that I had a voice for radio. And I said, yeah, I've also been told I have a face radio also.
Yeah, that's the joke. That's the joke, yeah.